All right, welcome to the Free Stretch Week 6 edition of the show. I am Bobby Fenton. We have got a 4-1 football team as we get set for Bucks 49ers on Sunday now, late afternoon at 4:25 p.m. from Raymond James Stadium. And we're going to get it all done today on the heels of a thrilling 38-35 win out in Seattle. Thank you for joining us here on JoeBucksFan.com. Bobby Fenton with you on the single best place anywhere, TV, internet, radio, for Buccaneer coverage. And I want to thank the Joes at JoeBucksFan.com, as always, for giving me the platform. We've got a lot to get to today because, as always, you know, we do this show late in the week. I still want to go over a few things from the Seattle game while then looking ahead to the San Francisco game. As the Bucs have a chance now to go 5-1 with a win, it would be only the sixth time, if they're able to do it, and it's going to be difficult on Sunday, but if they're able to do it, only the sixth time in franchise history, they would have been 6-1 through seven games. The other five instances were 1979, 1997, 2002, the Super Bowl year, 2005, and 2021. Now, to do that, they're going to have to beat a team that's got its issues of its own. The 49ers are coming off a great win against the Rams. They have a little mini bye, so they have a rest advantage because they played on Thursday night, which was the same as Seattle, who played on the prior Thursday night before playing the Bucks. They are coming over to our side of the country, obviously. It was going to be a 1 o'clock kickoff. It was flexed to 4:25, which for fans, especially fans going to the game, is very pleasant. Although the weather is supposed to be great. Like, the weather is going to cool down on Saturday in the central Florida area, not just Tampa. And it's supposed to be like cool and dry, like a little mini cold front that first one of the season all the way through early next week. So it'll be great anyway. But then, you know, those 1 o'clock games, the sun is directly overhead. For 4 o'clock games, it's starting to set, especially if you're on the west side of the stadium. So it should just be a real pleasant afternoon in the stands, at least. Will it be a pleasant afternoon on the field? We'll see. But the Bucs keep finding ways. And I'll tell you what right now. If you're a person who's really into numbers, if you're really a person who's into like underlying metrics and predictive models and things like that, and some people are more inclined toward these things than others, okay, then you're probably a little bit, I don't want to say hesitant but right now, but you've taken pause. The Bucks are grading out, if you look at things like DVOA, which is something that Football Outsiders does, which is a really good metric. It's not the end-all, be-all, but it doesn't care about anything but what actually happens on every down, every play, every possession, every game. And it doesn't, for example, if a team like the Bucks did kicks a game-winning field goal as time expires, it doesn't really care that much about that one play. It's just one play. It cares about how the whole game was played. And that's not to dismiss the actual records. Of course, we don't want to do that. We're 4-1. But it's just to say, okay, here's how good the actual teams are looking forward. Bucks are a middle-of-the-pack team if you focus on just those. Now, numbers don't quantify everything. They certainly don't quantify gritty playmaking ability. And that's where the Bucks shine the most on Sunday, on both sides of the ball. And I say both sides of the ball because defensively they did not have a good game at all. In fact, I'm worried about the defense. But, and my friend Darren McClain, who was with me, we were watching the game on Sunday, and we were going the whole game just bitching about the defense, giving up this and giving up that, like most of you probably were as well, and going back and forth. Then the Bucks somehow tied the game at 35 as time was getting very lean. But there was still time for Seattle, and they had just moved up and down the field like a sickle through a ripe wheat field all day long. And we were all like, oh, God, here we go. They're just going to go walk it off with a field goal. And Darren said, you know what? Tough day for the defense, but someone has to make a play. Right now, someone has to make a play. And the Bucs defense made one. Antoine Winfield made one. Levante David made one. Logan Hall's helmet made one. And they got it done. And here was my thing all day. I say this all the time on this show. You guys, if you listen to me any amount of time, already know what I'm about to say. For those that haven't listened, in football, especially modern football, I'm a firm believer in this. I mean, there's all these different things that go into being a successful organization. There's all these things that go into winning and losing. And obviously, the quarterback is the most important one. The GM-head coach combo is huge. But I always say it over and over and over, pass rush, pass rush, pass rush, pass rush. It's really hard to be good It's really hard to stop anybody, and it's really hard to win games in the NFL if you cannot rush the passer. And the Bucs couldn't do it all day on Sunday. And they were trying to do it with four, and they just simply could not do it with four. And they didn't want to send any more than four. And I get it, because they had injuries in the secondary. So there's two schools, there's two ways of looking at that, two schools of thought. Todd Bowles said after the game, we didn't really pressure much all day until that last play where they got the pick. And when he says pressure, he means blitz. He said, we didn't really pressure much all day because we got injuries in the secondary. I mean, they had, you know, Kendall Vildor back there starting, and not even his normal position, but he's starting at outside corner. It's tough, man. It's tough. So if we send guys, that's fewer people in the secondary to help out an already lean secondary. Okay, that's one way of looking at it. The other way of looking at it is if you don't send anybody, you're asking that depleted secondary to cover for even longer. I personally thought they should have started scheming up more pressure earlier than they did. And I always say, I'm not, these guys have forgotten more football in the last 10 minutes than I'll ever know in my entire life. Always say that when I say anything critical of coaching. All the staff, not just Todd Bowles, everybody involved. Okay, I admit that. And yet I'm watching us with four not getting there. And Hassan Reddick, you know, he's okay. Yaya had a couple pressures. I mean, those guys just aren't enough. And like I said, I am worried about the Bucs defense and their pass rush. But anyway, not getting four to get anywhere near Sam Darnold, he didn't even have to think about pressure, let alone actually be pressured, let alone actually be sacked. Okay? So if you can't get pressure with four, you have to scheme it. You have to send blitzes. You have to get more creative and try something because he absolutely picked them apart. So the Bucs finally did it on that final play, and Antoine Winfield gets a clean run at Darnold. And what does Darnold do? And he wasn't trying to throw it to somebody. He was trying to throw it away. He was just trying to throw it down. But Logan Hall's helmet, it bounces off. And it's funny because, like, Lavonte David's dropped a few. Our Bucs defense in general has dropped a few that look like catchable picks. So it's funny Lavonte catches the one that, like, hits a helmet, changes direction, has a weird spin, and he catches that one. But, like my friend Darren said, someone had to make a play, and finally they did. And Todd Bowles made a play from the sideline by calling and finally dialing up some pressure. And then Winfield had to get in there and get it. And then the throw was bad, and Lavonte had to go in there and catch it, and he did. And they were already in field goal range when that happened. They got a few more yards. Chase McLaughlin goes in there, makes another one to win it. 38-35 is your final. But I'll say again, pass rush, pass rush, pass rush, pass rush. And they just, you know, they couldn't get any all day, and they were getting absolutely torn apart. And part of it was the special teams, too. I mean, the special teams, there was improvement this weekend in that nothing got blocked. No punts or field goals or anything like that. No place kicks got blocked, let alone return. But still, the kickoff coverage was very poor. I mean, it seemed like every time the Bucs scored, they'd kick off, and Seattle was probably only two or three, but it felt like more on these kickoffs. Seattle would be back at the 40, 45, midfield. Although I say that, and even when we did, the Bucs did pin them deep before what could have been the game-winning drive when it was 28-28. They got them pinned down at the one-yard line. Seattle still had an eight-play, 99-yard drive from there. So it wasn't all special teams that hurt the defense. The defense hurt itself. And so after that, it was 35-28. And I even tweeted on my Twitter account, at Bobby Game Day. I said, you know what, I'm okay. Just let them score. If they score fast, at least we have the chance to score back. And the Bucs did that. And then even they scored kind of quick. And Seattle had a chance to go back and win it again until they turned it over on the interception. But my thing on Sunday was really just the lack of a pass rush and the inability. And I know there were some hurries, I guess. There was a critical fourth down where they scored, where it looked like Yaya finally got around the edge, but he couldn't quite get Darnold in his grasp. And Darnold stepped up through it and rolled out left. That was the other thing, besides lack of pass rush, lack of contain. If you're not going to get home on pass rush, at least let's not have our ends just completely collapsing in. And then even if you do get at some pressure, the quarterback, in this case, Darnold, just has to sidestep a little bit. And that is just wide open out in the tips. He can run left or right. That happened a few times. And Darnold's not exactly a runner who's going to burn you, but he did because the contain wasn't there. At least contain if you can't get there. So tough day. I know the secondary itself wasn't bad. I didn't think Vildor was bad. I thought Jacob Parrish did an admirable job. He was all over Cup. A couple of those catches Cup made, I mean, you would have liked to have seen Parrish defend them. But he was right on him, and they just really, really tough catches, and Cup came up with it. But I didn't think the secondary as a whole, I mean, I shouldn't say they weren't bad. They just weren't as bad as it seemed, let's put it that way. They were bad too. But again, to me, it's hard to look good. I don't care who your secondary is or who's hurt and who's not. If you just have a guy back there with unlimited time, you're going to get your ass lit up in the NFL, period. I don't care who you are. So I'm not excusing the secondary. Both quarterbacks put up insane numbers, but someone had to make a play, and Lavonte David finally made one as Sam Darnold was trying to throw it away. And there were a lot of guys who deserve mention on Sunday, mostly from the offense, but I mean, Baker Mayfield, again, the guy, he's reined in the turnovers, and that was the big thing. And I know he had the one against Philly, but overall, I mean, his interception numbers are low now. And he's got the playmaking gene. We all know that. He's still making plays with his legs on third or fourth down to find a way. And some of the throws he made on Sunday. I mean, the second touchdown to Ibuka. The one, the little seam, little skinny post there in the end zone when they were moving right to left. I mean, that throw was on his breastplate. Like, Amika Ibuka caught the ball, but more so the ball kind of caught Ibuka because it just landed where his arms were, like right in his chest. This is an amazing throw, and there were many like that. He's done a great job finding Sterling Shepard, who continues to be unbelievably helpful, and for a number five at the beginning of the year, wide receiver, to come in and have the impact Sterling Shepard has and to step up with the injuries they've had. That's one reason why the Bucs are 4-1, is because of guys like that. And a great relationship between Mayfield, and they go back to Oklahoma, obviously, Mayfield and Sterling Shepard, and the way he's been able to find him in some of the biggest spots and some of the most desperate spots for the offense. I don't even know what to say about Ibuka anymore. I mean, it's getting to the point of ridiculousness now with him. And it's here's the territory we're in, because I'm so scarred as watching the Bucs and knowing how it's gone with the injuries. Every time Ibuka gets targeted, let alone makes a catch, I'm immediately just saying, don't get hurt. Nice catch. Don't get hurt. Don't get hurt. Don't get hurt. You know, that's what I'm doing every time now, because I'm just like, please don't let anything happen to him. Chris Godwin, you know, again, not, you know, still working his way back. Now he's dinged up. We'll talk about the injuries going into San Francisco here in a little bit, but I guess he's sore or his leg's not feeling great, hasn't practiced this week, so I'm not sure he'll even play. That's not official yet, but right now it looks like it's very possible he won't play. But guys keep stepping up. Let me talk about Tez Johnson for a minute. Tez Johnson, first of all, the stat line was four catches. All four of his targets he caught, four catches for Tez, and he had 59 yards. But that's not even what I want to talk about. Here's one of those things that tells me, and you talk about all the good things Jason Light has done in the draft and all the guys he's able to find at all points of the draft, from the top to the bottom. Seventh round pick for Tez Johnson, okay? If you watch, and John Ledyard, if you go on Twitter to John Ledyard's account, he's good, tweets a lot of good football stuff. It's Bucs-centric. He kind of focuses on the Bucs, even though he tweets about the whole league. But he tweeted some stuff from the All-22 footage. Nothing endears a player to my heart more than when they do the little things, than when they're completely alert and aware and engaged, and they are all out to try to win the football game, or whatever, any sport, and they're all out to try to win the game, and they understand what it takes to win it beyond just the obvious thing of, you know, whatever their number one job is. So, Tez Johnson, go look at the footage on John Ledyard's Twitter account. When the Bucs were in a hurry trying to tie the game up in the fourth quarter there at the end of the game, they hit a pass to Ibuka, who caught it kind of right on the hash, got tackled, clock's running. Tez Johnson immediately runs up to Ibuka. You can see it on the film. He's yelling to him to toss him the ball so he can get it to the referee so they can spot it a little bit quicker. This isn't even a catch Tez Johnson made. This is Ibuka making a catch. Tez Johnson completely is just dialed in. He's 1,000,000% involved and committed to this offense going down and scoring and the Bucs winning the game. He's not being, and this isn't something that he did selfishly, like, oh, this will show up on film or this will make me look good. This is something nobody would ever notice most of the time. That's why I wanted to mention John Ledyard, because I appreciated him posting this, because I missed it myself when I was watching the game and I didn't see this. It happened again. Remember they hit Otten? Cade Otten down the sideline when Otten lowered his head and just plowed into that guy when he was going down toward the end zone. Again, you can see it on the All-22 film. Tez Johnson's right there trying to block downfield. And that's another thing. He did a great job blocking downfield. He's yelling at Otten. You can see it on the film. He's yelling at Otten to get out of bounds. Otten doesn't do it. But right when Otten doesn't do it, Johnson immediately shifts into yelling at him. You can see it again. Give me the ball, give me the ball. Otten, who's still on the ground, instead of taking all the extra time to get up, flips him the ball, and Johnson catches it and goes and gets it right to the referee so they can spot the ball a little bit quicker. Just little stuff that almost nobody, even at the pro level, you see doing. And I get off on this stuff, guys. I really do. Like, as somebody who has coached, especially now with kids, I've been coaching my son in T-ball all the way through. Now he's almost in high school and flag football. And I'm always, you're at that age, you're just trying to get him to learn the basics and just do stuff right. But if you can teach him things like that, like to really understand what the team is trying to do and how you can help the team do it beyond just catch ball, run ball, you know, that type of stuff, score touchdown. Yeah, we know that, but there's more to it. And to see Tez Johnson doing that stuff, I mean, that's like burrowing deep inside my heart. Love the guy even more now than I even thought I or even realized I did before. So like I said, the stat line, 4 targets, caught all 4 of them, and he had 59 yards. But he was playing like his hair was on fire. He was just completely committed. Every downfield block on the screen passes. I mean, he had one that sprung Rashad White, did a great job. And then going and trying to get the ball spotted in the 2-minute drill, helping out any way he can, always being there, always knowing what to do, always knowing what needs to be done. I love it. I mean, I'm smitten. Never mind everybody else, Abuka himself or everything else the Bucs have done. But I wanted to mention Tez Johnson specifically there for what a great job he did. Speaking of blocking downfield, Wirfs was unbelievable. He's just mowing people down at all 3 levels. Like he mows this guy down, then he runs up and gets a backer, then he'll even go up and get a safety. He did it on a couple of plays where he actually blocked 3 different guys in 1 play at 3 different levels. So I wanted to mention him. And Rashad White himself, you know, Bucky Irving was out. A great game from Rashad White. I thought, again, doing the little things, you know, new to slide, not go out of bounds when he wanted to make Seattle use their last timeout late in the game there. Did a great job picking up blitzes. I mean, he was, and these are things, again, you don't notice so much when you're watching the game because you're just focused on the outcome of the play. But he did a great job, and he's always been good at it. Great job in blitz pickup. And you know Rashad White, if everything I know, he and Bucky Irving are friends, and I it's always tough. Like, I'm sure they like each other, but at the same time, you know Rashad White sees himself as a number one back, wants to be a number one back, and is good enough to be a number one back. We are fortunate with the Bucs to have an embarrassment of riches where a guy like Rashad White isn't even the starter. But that's what, like, you know, Bucky couldn't go on Sunday, and you get White coming in and doing that stuff. And, I mean, just really selfless. It's just a really, the Bucs have a good, I don't know what's going to happen. Like I said, they might not be nearly as good as we think. They've been eking their way out, even against some lesser teams. They've got a ton of injuries. This season may not be destined for all that much, or maybe it's destined for great things. I have no idea, okay? I'm not even making a prediction on their win-loss record or their playoffs or anything like that. But I think it's clear through 5 games now, they've got a really good culture, and they've got a really good, like, up and down the organization, starting with Jason Light, or starting with the Glazers, for that matter, who I've been critical of many times in the past, but starting with them all the way down through the scouts, Light himself, the coaching staff. I mean, these guys, we got a pretty good situation. I, as a fan of the Bucs, appreciate the situation because there's always, you know, especially if you look back over Bucs history, but you don't even have to do that. You can just look around the league right now. How many teams wish they could change so many different things? The only thing I'd change about the Bucs, I'd change 2 things. I'd get more pass rush that I wish they were better with, and I'd fix the injuries, which are a thing you can't really do anything about. But beyond that, there's not much I'd change about this team. And I say that knowing full well they may hit the skids down the stretch and end up not even being that good, you know. But they're doing it right. And so when you do it right, you know, maybe it's not so random that they keep eking out these close games. Because I say all the time how random the NFL can be, and it's a small sample size, and one call, one, you know, one missed kick or one made kick or one missed tackle or one ball bouncing off the helmet, you know, that changes your whole season. Whereas in baseball, there's so many games that it all evens out. In football, it doesn't. Like, you can have a really good year or a really bad year and be the same exact team, but just based on luck and randomness, you know, things either go your way or they don't. With the Bucs, like the old saying goes, you make your own luck. I mean, they've been a little bit fortunate, but a lot of it's because of the way they do things. And so here sitting at 4-1, you know, that could easily be 2-3 or even 3-2 or something like that. But to be 4-1, Yes, it's some parts luck. Yeah, it's some parts being pretty fortunate in some spots, but it's a lot of other parts in making your own luck and doing things the right way top to bottom, and things just magically sort of working out when you do that. And that goes for life in general as well. So really, really happy with the offensive side of things on Sunday. Obviously, defensively, it wasn't their best day. But the defense, I mean, the offense struggled at points this year where the defense has picked them up. And one of the reasons they're 4-1 is because some of those efforts the defense gave earlier in the season. So this Sunday, it was the offense's turn, and they were on fire. And now it just becomes a thing. I mean, looking at these numbers. Oh, one other guy I wanted to mention before I move on to San Francisco. Josh Grizzard thought he took a big step forward as a play caller and an offensive coordinator on Sunday. He got Kate Otten more involved. You know, they haven't been using the tight ends much. In fact, I think they're 32nd, or they were going into the Seattle game, 32nd of 32 in tight end targets or tight end usage. And a lot of that was because they just needed all the help they could get blocking, so they were leaving tight ends in to help block. But I think Grizzard identified, okay, let's get Kate Otten going here. Of course, it was kind of a return. He went to the University of Washington. I don't think that's the reason, but it was a good weekend to do it, and he made a lot of big plays for the Bucs, catching the football, not just blocking. The play-action game was really well used. The Bucs, I'm always talking about, I mean, play-action is, to me, play-action is a cheat code. Like, we know from the numbers, we know how well play-action works and how effective it can be, and that goes for every team, and it doesn't matter even if you have a running attack. People think, oh, you have to have a good running attack for play-action to work. No. Just you could pass the ball 80 times in a row and play action on the 81st, and it would freeze the linebacker for that extra little split second that you need to help out. It's just the way people are trained. It's the way they grew up. Play action works. And the Bucs hadn't used it that much in the first quarter of the season, but on Sunday, Josh Grizzard really got it going, and it was to outstanding results. Baker Mayfield, 13 dropbacks in play action. On those 13 dropbacks, 11 of 12 for 135 yards. And I guess you could pick any passing stat, and it would look good on Sunday because, I mean, what was he, 87.5% or something? It was the single highest completion percentage of any single game this year by a quarterback so far in 2025. But that was one that deserves mention as well. So now we get ready to play the 49ers, who've beaten the Bucs 4 times in a row. They've played, it seems like they play every year, and they have, because the 49ers have been winning their division, and the Bucs have too. So even when they're not scheduled to play each other in the cycle, you always play everybody who finished in the same spot you did in your conference. So the Bucs and 49ers have been playing a lot. Last year was one of the most bitter losses of the season, if you remember. That was the game where Baker Mayfield had that amazing fourth down conversion with Bosa on his back, and he still completed the pass. But then they only settled for a field goal, and they didn't score a touchdown. Then the Niners missed they missed two kicks, but still won. They had the game-winning touchdown pass. Anyway, now this year, fast forward, same thing. Game is in Tampa. Brock Purdy, and I was looking at his injury last week, and they were saying, well, they're not sure if he's going to be able to play even next week, let alone on that Thursday night or this past week. And I was thinking, okay, that's interesting. But now after seeing what Mac Jones was able to do on Thursday, there's not that much of a drop-off. And I think Purdy's really good. I'm not saying he's not, but he's not. I don't think there's a ton of drop-off between Mac Jones and Brock Purdy. And Mac Jones is 3-0 as a starter. And obviously, again, same thing for Kittle. George Kittle is George Kittle. He is really good. But, you know, Jake Tongas has been doing some incredible stuff for them at tight end. But here's the thing. The 49ers, both teams, both defenses are coming off of a very, very rough defensive effort. And the Bucs obviously gave up a million points. The 49ers only gave up 23 to the Rams. And yet, again, the underlying metrics, I mean, Matt Stafford threw for 389 and 3 TDs for them, for the Rams against the 49ers last week. He had 47 dropbacks. So this is another thing that encourages me about this weekend. The pass rush for the opposition, our offensive line, who I'm talking about now, has a decent chance to maybe settle in a little bit, because Stafford dropped back 47 times against the Rams. He was only hit. This isn't even sacked. He was only hit 2 of those 47, and they got 1 sack. Like I said, he had almost 400 yards and 3 TDs. I said 2 TDs. 3 TDs for the Rams in that game, and they came up short anyway. So they didn't give up as many points as the Bucs did against Seattle, but San Francisco's defense has had issues roughing the passer, and their secondary has had some issues as well. So hopefully the Bucs can exploit that. On the other side of the ball, I'm already getting night sweats thinking about, I mean, Christian McCaffrey has not run the ball that well, and the 49ers as a team haven't run the ball that well, and the Bucs, up until this past weekend at least, have done a good job against the run. But McCaffrey's still been a very big threat as a receiver, and I'm getting night sweats already thinking about Servasia Dennis just trying to do anything involving Christian McCaffrey catching a football out of the backfield. And it, I mean, Dennis has been good against the run too. On Sunday, I mean, on that one, on the touchdown, I can't remember who it was for Seattle, on the one touchdown, we even rewound it on our DVR watching the game. We were like, what the F is Dennis even doing here? It looked like the old vibrator, like the vibrating football game. Remember that little metal table that vibrated and you put the players on it and then you'd flip the switch and the vibration would start and they'd all run around and like there'd be that one odd piece that would just be going in a circle or something. That's what it looked like Servasia Dennis was doing. And this was pointed out on Twitter, it almost, like Vita Vea, you could argue, is better dropping out of the nose tackle spot like the Bucs do sometimes into the flat and covering people. He's almost better in coverage than Servasia Dennis is. I don't even think it's almost. I think he actually is better at it. And Vea's going to get a pick eventually. He came close. He's been trying to like bait one into those passes in the flat, and he hasn't been able to come up with it. But like Dennis just looks lost in pass coverage. I don't know what it is about that position that the Bucs haven't been able to find the guy. And we all talked about how his injury last year, I'm talking about Dennis, was so big. And after they lost him is when things really fell apart. But now that he's healthy, the Bucs are going to have that linebacker that can be good in coverage. And we didn't really have a lot to go on because Dennis only played a game and a half last year. But we were just looking at the drop-off in the defense, and we all said, oh, well, that's the problem. It was Dennis getting hurt. That's why. No, it wasn't that. He's not good in pass coverage either. They don't have that guy right now. But there's a reason Deion Jones hasn't played ahead of him. So I wouldn't look for a change. I mean, if there was a change, I wouldn't look for like a huge difference to be made or else they would have done it already. But I am a little bit concerned about that, I have to admit. So these are all things to look for on Sunday as the Bucs try to go 5-1. And I mean, that win on this past Sunday over Seattle, I mean, I'm not going to say it's a bonus because I expect the Bucs to win every game. They have a chance to win every game. They're good enough to win every game. But I'll put it this way. I was mentally prepared for that not to be a win, both before the game and certainly in the fourth quarter with everything that was happening. And for them to pull a game like that off, which is a game they lose 9 times out of 10 normally, was really, really impressive and showed a lot of mettle. And it matters. I mean, you stockpile these wins now because it's not always going to go their way. They're going to lose games like that too. If you keep playing games like that, and they've played 5 of them now that were decided by one possession, and the 4 they won, they all won them in the final minute, either by breaking a tie or coming from behind in the final minute. All 4 of them have been like that. And if you keep doing that, you're going to lose. I mean, you're not going to do that every time. And I'd love for there to be a quiet, you know, stress-free win where the Bucs win like, you know, 31-17 or something. That'd be great, you know, if that could happen. But the reality is that these games are close a lot of the time. And so, you know, you're going to win some, you're going to lose some. But when you can stockpile the wins they've already stockpiled, it doesn't hurt as much if they don't win a game like this weekend or one of the ones down the road. And looking at the schedule, I mean, we've been saying, you know, get through. The schedule was a little bit light at first. I don't want to say light, but like, you know, the Jets, although that was a tough game, it was a game you know they should have won maybe more easily. But the schedule got tougher here in the past few weeks because you had Seattle, now you have the Niners, then you've got Detroit, and the Eagles. So we were saying go 2-2 in those games, and then everything else takes care of itself. Well, so far they're 1-1 in those games, and if they can go 1-1 in the next couple and then beat the Saints going into the bye, that would put them at 6-2 going into the bye. That'd be just fine. Now, yeah, I never want to concede a loss. I hope they're, you know, whatever the maximum, or they're 4-1, I hope they're 7-1 then going into the bye. But realistically, that win in Seattle now gives you the ability to split the next two. I'm not even going to pencil in a win against the Saints. You can't pencil anything in, but at least that one, the Bucs will be a decent favorite in going in. And if they can, you know, Detroit Monday night's going to be tough next week. If they had lost that Seattle game, it would feel a lot more pressure-packed going into this game on Sunday. I hope the Bucs don't play this way, though. I hope they play as if they did lose to Seattle. But if they had lost that, now they're 3-2. Now they're staring at two really tough games right in the face. And now they're looking at like trying to stay a game above 500 going into the bye week, you know, or at 500 going into the bye week. But instead, they're 4-1. And this is just how huge it is when it's in a sport that only plays 17 games. I mean, you know, one win or loss here or there makes a gigantic difference. So to pick up wins like that, that they've done over and over, and Sunday, I really did not think they were going to win the football game toward the end. You know when I thought the game was not going to be won? I'll tell you. When they got the pick, they were already up a touchdown. They got the interception. And they made that completely atrocious illegal contact call. Overturned the interception. A few plays later, Seattle scores. Now instead of being up two scores, which the Bucs were about to be, because they would have the ball in like right around midfield and already up seven. They could have gotten a field goal at least out of that. Instead of that, now we're tied. Right then and there, I said, you know, it's not their day. It's just too hard to overcome garbage like this. I'm not even like trying to be complaining about the refs guy, but that illegal contact penalty really pissed me off. And it was just so, it was so unnecessary. Like, it was so routine. There was nothing to indicate anything that doesn't happen on every single play. And of course, on the one play that's like a turning point in the game, here comes a flag when, you know, it overturns an interception, which were hard to come by. Anyway, that was when I thought, okay, you know what? I started mentally preparing myself not to be too upset about a loss because that's probably what's going to happen. And it didn't. They found, even after giving up the touchdown to tie the game, they fought back. And every step of the way, they never relented. And this team has just been really, really good at that and has always found ways. So we'll see what they can do on Sunday. Talking about the injuries, though, we've gotten this far into the show and not going over the Bucs injuries. It is Thursday, a little after 2 p.m., as I record this right now. I always say that because the injury information I'm giving you, you know, people listen to podcasts, unlike live radio. You could be listening to this on Saturday, for all I know, or even Sunday before the game. I think you should fire my show up when you're tailgating in the grass lots at RJS. I think you should just put me on in the background. You don't have to hang on every word. Just let my voice kind of be present while you're out there. I want to walk the parking lot on Sunday because my mom lives right there. I park at her house usually, and then I walk through the parking lot to the stadium. I want to walk through the parking lot and hear my voice somewhere. Somebody fire that thing up on Sunday. If you do, I'll immediately find you and I'll come say hello. But anyway, if you're listening to this in any, you know, time in the future, then you may have more information than I'm giving you right now. But as of right now on Thursday, so Zion McCollum, who looked fine on Sunday itself but got hurt during the course of the game, had a procedure, they're saying, on his thumb. He's been in a sling this week, did not practice today. Chris Godwin did not practice today. Bucky Irving did not practice today. And Mike Evans and Benjamin Morrison all did not practice today. Now, Mike Evans isn't probably going to be back this weekend. We weren't thinking that, neither is Morrison or Bucky. Godwin, though, like I said, that one, it's very possible he couldn't play, although there wasn't any indication of something being wrong earlier in the week. Zion, they haven't ruled out, even though he hasn't practiced, if he can get out of this sling or whatever it is with his thumb. More details forthcoming. Jamel Dean was out there, so that's a good sign. To get him back would be nice. Christian Izian, who's another underrated one, would be nice to get him back. And he was out there practicing today, so those two guys are looking good. So was Mike Jordan, who has been filling in at guard, was being a practice squad elevation every time he was playing, so he didn't have to officially be listed on the injury reports because of that. And he's still got one more elevation left. So we'll see if they go with Haggard again at guard, or if Mike Jordan is healthy enough, and even if he is, what they decide to do there. But that's possible. Although Charlie Heck was a little bit better this weekend, not too bad. The right side of the line and is looking a little bit better now. And it may need to, because here's another thing, and you saw this if you visit JoeBucksFan.com. Albert Breer, who Joe Bucks fan, you know, the Joes have a lot of respect for, usually when he says things, you know, he's pretty well connected. On his podcast, this is just kind of a throwaway line, but he was talking about how impressive what the Bucks have done is, and he said, you know, they got two starting offensive linemen, out for the year. It was like, what do you mean two? Who said anything about two? You know, we know, obviously, Cody Mauch is out for the year. And then it was like, well, does he know something about Gedeky that nobody else knows? And it might have just been he misspoke, or he might have just exaggerated. Joe wrote a little piece on JoeBucksFan.com saying, you know, that's a little worrisome, though. Or maybe he knows something the rest of us don't already. Now, Gedeky can't come back until after next week anyway because of the four-game IR thing. But, you know, a lot of people are thinking, okay, well, he's coming back the minute he's eligible. And what if it's longer, you know? I don't know. Nobody knows right now. Although Gedeki looked fine. I mean, he was there and like walking around and not even limping, not in a boot. Like he looks like he's getting close to okay. So hopefully, like I said, maybe Breer just misspoke or something. I don't know. But that's something to keep an eye on. And in the meantime, though, the injury report for once looks worse for the other guys, as San Francisco has a long list of theirs than it does for the Bucks, which is something not very common. We get CBS, not Fox, on Sunday. You get Nance and Romo, so some of you may like that, some of you may dislike that, but that's the broadcast crew for Sunday and 425 kickoff, which should be a lot of fun. I'm glad they flexed this game. I always like the 425 kickoffs, even if you, whether you're going or not, it just feels like a little bit bigger game when it's at 425, and plus it just, you know, it gives you more time throughout the day to kind of, you know, get yourself going. 1 o'clock hits me in the face. I'm not a late sleeper, but on Sunday mornings I play my ultimate frisbee game. Then I'm exhausted from that. My legs are usually sore. I come home, I jump in the pool, get cleaned up, and it's like kickoff in 10 minutes when I do that. It's like, whoa, you know. So the 425 kind of lets everybody have a little more tailgating, take care of whatever they need to before heading over to the stadium, or even if you're not, just kind of, you know, it frames the weekend better. I like having it kind of anchoring that Sunday afternoon. And certainly for weather purposes, it'll be nicer as well. What else? Oh, you know, there's a couple things around the NFL I always like to bring up on the show. And one of the ones I want to bring up today, before we wrap it up, is this whole thing with Amari DiMercato, the running back for the Cardinals. If you didn't see the game on Sunday, they were playing the Titans. They were leading handily, and then DiMercato broke one through. He's a running back. Got into the clear, sure thing touchdown, and did that thing we've seen time and time again for some reason. I still can't figure out why, but he dropped the ball on purpose before actually getting to the goal line. Ball was ruled a fumble. Tennessee recovered. Instead of a touchdown that would have put them up, I believe, 22 points and probably all but sealed that game, the game wasn't quite over yet, and Tennessee, lo and behold, did come back and win the football game. And now the Cardinals are 2-3 instead of 3-2 because of it. So there was footage that emerged of Cardinals head coach Jonathan Gannon, who like looked like he was literally maybe going to bite off his own tongue or just explode like right there on the sideline. He was so angry. And I completely understand it. And so he walks up to DiMercato, and his teeth are gritted. You can tell like he's ready to blow. And he's trying to keep it together. And he gets right up close to DiMercato, kind of leans over to like where your mouth is near the other guy's ear. And you can see like that little head bob where a guy's like really talking, like, you know, like really pissed off. And he kind of smacks him. I always say hits him, but he smacks him open-handed on the shoulder pad, like right in the like chest area. Nothing big or anything like that. But he put hands on him, and not in the type of like, hey, go get him champ way either. Like, you know, he put aggressive, angry hands on him. And then he did it again as he departed. He gave him one more little smack there again. Now, you wouldn't say he hit him. Too far to go to say that. But anyway, it became kind of a controversy, you know? I mean, it was, you know, obviously he was justified in being angry, but it became a controversy. Like, is this how coaches should be able to talk to players? Should a coach ever put his hands on a player in that manner? All that type of thing. So the Cardinals, actually, this isn't the league now. Teams can fine their own guys, too, and maybe the Cardinals wanted to preempt anything the league might do. But the Cardinals have fined Jonathan Gannon $100,000 for that. He's not suspended. He's not fired or anything. $100,000 fine. And then there are people on the other side saying, oh, my God, he did nothing wrong. This is ridiculous. There's certain times in life where I dig in and I take a side, and there's a clear opinion, and I'll fight, you know, I'll die on that hill or whatever you want to call it. And there's other times where I really do see both sides. So I kind of get both sides here. I think if you're the Cardinals, you have to do something that says, no, you can't put your hands on a player like that. And other players, like even James Harrison, who's an ex-player, other guys were tweeting saying, oh, you put your hands on me. No, you don't do that. I get it. I totally get that. And it's funny because like it is a grown man thing, because like if a high school coach did exactly what Gannon did to a kid, I wouldn't think a single thing of it. And it's funny because it should be the opposite, right? Like the kid is the one who doesn't have agency. A kid is the one who has less power. He's the one who, and some of you may argue, no, it's not okay for a high school either. But it's for whatever reason, I feel like if that happened to me as a player when I was in high school, I wouldn't have even thought anything of it. And it never did. I'm not accusing any of my high school coaches of that. But I'm saying, that's no big deal. But yet when it's, and even in college, I'd say it's, I think the older you get up the scale until now, it's peer to peer, like grown man to grown man. Grown man to grown man, I think there's more wrong with it than it would have been if it was like a younger kid. And even if it was like an older head coach and a younger man, even then it would have thought less of it. But it's the fact that they're about the same age, because Gannon's a young coach. To me, I see the Cardinals side. But let's look at the other side now. Not to excuse it, okay? Do you have any idea how much pressure these guys are under? I'm talking about head coaches, okay? Here's a guy, again, Gannon's a young coach. I assume he wants to have a career as a head coach instead of being a head coach for 2 or 3 years and getting fired and then going back to being a coordinator or in a position coach for the rest of his life. And you have to, I mean, do you know how competitive? Let's think about this for a second. If I asked you, what's the most competitive environment on the face of the planet? I mean, like the single most competitive environment anywhere on the planet. Number one would probably be like nature itself, right? Like, I don't think you could argue with that. Like nature, where you're literally fighting for your life and you're a cheetah or you're a gazelle and you're running and the other guy's running after you and the loser's going to get killed. Either the loser's not going to have enough food to eat or the loser's going to literally be eaten. I'll say that's number one, okay, right? Nature, number one, most competitive. What's the most competitive environment in all of humanity, though? Let's rule out nature and just talk about humans, okay? Because I think it's professional sports. Like, there is nothing. I know there's different professions and different jobs, and there's lots of things that are competitive in different ways. But you were talking about the most hyper-competitive environment that humankind has come up with, probably on the face of the planet, right? And the tremendous pressure these coaches are under, and how difficult it is to just win one game in the NFL, let alone have a winning season. And now you're 2-3 instead of 3-2 because a guy, and not even because a guy just couldn't quite get it done, or a guy came up short, or the other guy made a great play. No, he just dropped the ball willfully and took a win away from you. I think Jonathan Gannon deserves a $100,000 reward for not punching DeMarcado, let alone just giving him a little open-handed, like, little shiver. Big deal. Because, guys, I'm nuts, and I'm not really a great role model, and I probably shouldn't have coached youth sports as much as I did, but coaching my son's flag football team, if a kid did that, I'd be beside myself. I would have to excuse myself from the premises and let one of the other dads take over coaching the rest of the game, because I would lose it. I know nobody cares. Like, nobody remembers Bobby Fenton's flag football record as head coach except me, but I still think about certain losses and certain plays we could have made in the Under Armour, Under Armour Rise Skyway over there off the Veterans Football League. From years before, I can still remember games we lost. Oh, we should have been 4-3 that year. We finished 3-4 because so-and-so missed a kid in the end zone that we had it in goal line. That's like kids flag football. I can't even imagine an NFL game as a head coach and losing it because of something like that. Like, I'd go completely berserk. So, like I said, I think Gannon showed magnificent restraint, in my opinion, to go out there and only do what he did. You can look the footage up on Twitter or somewhere on the internet if you haven't seen it already. But anyway, I wanted to bring it up. By the way, it's the first time a coach has been fined for putting hands on a player since when? Does anybody want to take a guess? I'll wait a second just to give you guys a chance to guess, because some of you may know. It involves the Bucks. The last time until this that a head coach was fined for putting hands on a player. You ready? Okay, it was Bruce Arians for doing like a little, and it was, Arians' thing was kind of innocent. Bruce Arians kind of did a hand swipe at Andrew Adams' helmet in the wild card game against the Eagles in January 2022, so the 2021 season. And that was a game the Bucks won. But if you look at the footage of that one, Arians wasn't mad at him for like not, it, I think there was like jawing going on in the field, and Arians ran out there and tried to like get the players away, and he kind of smacked Adams on the helmet. So it wasn't like, it wasn't a big deal. That's probably why you don't remember it. Most of you, I didn't remember it until I read the stat. I had to go back and look at it. I didn't even remember that happened. But that's the last time until this that a Bucks, or any coach, excuse me, has been fined for putting hands on a player, and it was Arians. But this was obviously a lot more aggressive and directed directly at a player for a specific reason. So again, I get why it has to be a fine. I get why you can't do that. But I also get what possessed Gannon to do it, and I'm quite frankly surprised that he wasn't possessed to do more. Or if he was possessed to do more, I think he showed a great amount of maturity and restraint to not do it. Because I cannot believe in the year 2025, guys are still dropping the freaking football short of the goal line. I don't know if they think it looks cool. I don't know what they're doing. I don't know what. But it's just mind-boggling. And it cost the Cardinals a win. And it might cost Gannon his job, and it might tank their season. I mean, it's not like I said, it's not like there's 162 of these, and, oh, we'll get them tomorrow. There's only 17. And that can railroad your whole deal right there. And meanwhile, it's the Titans' first win. It's just the line's just that fine in the NFL. So anyway, I wanted to say my piece on that, but for now, we're all done. We've got a Sunday 4:15 battle at Raymond James Stadium, 49ers at Bucks. If you're going to the game, have fun. Enjoy the cool autumnal weather we're going to have for the next few days starting on late Friday or Saturday. But even if you're not going, have some friends over, get together for the game, make it an excuse to be social and enjoy the company of people you like being around. Either way, thanks to you all for listening. Thanks to the Joes at JoeBucksFan.com for giving me the platform, allowing me to be on the best website for Bucks coverage anywhere. I'm Bobby Fenton. That's the Free Stretch. We'll be back next week, hopefully, talking about a 5-1 football team. But either way, until then, wherever you are, good morning, good afternoon, good night, and go Bucks.